Bertrow against Kijakazi is our next case. Mr. Duncan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Dana Duncan on behalf of Eric Bertrow. This case comes before the court on one single issue, and the length of this oral argument will be based in part on that one single issue. It could go on for a few minutes, or it could go on for the entire length of my allotted time. But it's whether the ALJ has a duty of inquiry and a duty to develop the record in this particular case. The commissioner's position is that because the ALJ asked counsel if the record was complete, and he said it was, that that's sufficient. And the Supreme Court in Bistic has already discussed the fact there are no categorical rules. If you look at the case law on the duty to develop the record that exists throughout the 34, 40 years of Social Security disability jurisprudence, the cases that have been denied on the duty to develop the record have been such things where it's a minor medical issue or something that the record did not adequately develop. What we have here is, plain and simple, 5 years of missing records. And what was the obligation or what was the responsibility of the
ALJ? What do you think an ALJ is supposed to do when the lawyer for the claimant is asked, is the record complete, and says yes? Is the ALJ supposed to say, well, counsel, I'm assuming you're a liar. I'm just going to proceed on that assumption.
Doesn't need to say that, Your Honor. What he needs to do, though, is go, Mr. Bertrow.
He needs to proceed as if he's a liar without saying that to his face.
Correct. Because that's part of his duty.
That can't be right.
But that's the duty. These are informal hearings. Now, we have no question that if he's not represented by counsel, that he has greater latitude and greater responsibilities to acquire. The only thing we're asking in this case is the ALJ simply said, counsel, I've noticed that there are no records after 2015. This hearing is in 2020. Did he get treatment during that period of time? Because, quite frankly, in the few hundred hearings I have in a given year, administrative law judges will often ask about the fact that there's a reference to an MRI, but there's no MRI in the record. And then you have to address it. That kind of thing in and of itself would not trigger the duty. But we have 800 pages of additional records that are in this case. And it's relevant because not only is it we're talking about his Title II benefits with a date last insured in 2016, but the fact that he also was eligible for SSI benefits going forward. Now,
so let me make sure that I understand, Mr. Duncan, because
yep.
Your briefs were not at all clear on this, even in response to the government's response brief.
Yes.
But we're not limited to 2016.
No, because the decision itself included SSI benefits and a decision on SSI benefits, which would have been up through the date of the hearing itself. But as far as foreclosure, if he loses this, then his Title II benefits cannot be claimed at any point.
Understood.
Unless he gets reinsured.
But it's a little, I mean, frankly, it's a little hard to see a lot of medical evidence, particularly self-reported, which is what almost all this is, I think, self-reported symptoms from 2017, 18, 19, and 20 affecting an analysis of, meaningfully of his status in 2016.
But the problem with that, Your Honor, is that once you've established that there's a duty to defend or to develop the record, it's not this court's responsibility to weigh that evidence. That's Social Security's job.
Well,
and
that's
it's a harmless error.
You are proposing a totally unworkable standard here. At least, it seems to me. I don't understand a difference any difference in the standard you're proposing and the standard that we would apply to an unrepresented claimant. Is there any practical difference?
No, but the standard of review for harmless error.
So you're arguing there's a bright line rule that says even if counsel says the record is complete, the ALJ has failed if you later turn up records that were missing.
No. What we're talking about is not a bright line rule. It's not a categorical rule. It is a rule that's based upon reason. If we're talking about 3 months of missing records, no. If we're talking about a missing report here or there, no. What we're talking about is 5 years of records where the file just stops. I mean, there's at least an obligation at that point for the ALJ to make an inquiry as to why the record just stops. Did he not have treatment? Social Security ruling SSR 16-3P clearly indicates the judge is supposed to inquire about the failure to follow prescribed treatment. So he's going to have to ask what this prescribed treatment was. If he's not going to do that, how is he supposed to determine if he stopped treatment, for example, because of lack of insurance or ability to afford the treatment itself? So there is an obligation that extends beyond. And it's not going to be something that is going to automatically, in every case, trigger. But when you reach a point where there's 5 years and 800 pages of records pertaining to his migraine headaches, and the judge's final determination is, well, he must have gotten better because there's not really enough evidence here to say he's continuing to have them and getting treated for it.
Is that your argument on prejudice? I'm trying to factor in how the prejudice argument comes in.
Correct. There's enough evidence there. The standard for harmless error either is my position is frivolous, or there's a reasonableness that on remand, an ALJ may come to a different conclusion. You have to be certain that that different conclusion would exist. And looking at this evidence, while I admit it's not like an MRI or an X-ray, it's still, when you have migraine headaches, it's not easy to provide objective evidence of a migraine headache other than to have the
Mr. Duncan,
electronics attached.
What about the possibility of affirming with respect to disability insurance benefits and remanding as to the time actually covered for the for supplemental security income?
The only problem with that, Your Honor, is because of the fact that this court, as its sister courts have done, is that there's retroactive medical opinions and medical records. So in other words, records from 2017 and 2018 can be used conjunction with the
other. Sure, in theory.
Sure.
But we're looking at a specific record, and if I understand this correctly, the plaintiff was in 2016 was surfing, is that right?
Yes.
I've never seen that in a disability claimant before.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of bizarre things, Your Honor, through the years. And usually what ends up happening is you'll find things where they'll do something like that, and then afterwards the medical records show they really shouldn't have been doing that because they ended up doing a lot more damage to their health than they thought. But, yes. So, I guess the point being is, and I go back to the fact that these are supposedly informal hearings, and what the purpose is of an informal hearing. I mean, we have this very loose substantial evidence standard because of the fact that these are informal hearings. And as a result, the judges have a duty. I remember in the days when I started this 30-some years ago, the judges would sit down and tell you what they're finding in the record and what evidence they think's missing and what they think would help develop the case. Now we've gotten into this much more formalistic method and we have waivers and forfeitures and, you know, and all this.
You have one of the largest adjudicative systems in the world.
Yes.
It has to be with an incredible caseload per ALJ, and you seem to be saying they can never finish.
No, that's not exactly the case.
Except by finding disability.
No. No, that's not what I'm saying, because in this particular case, we're not asking to update the record for a few weeks or a few months or to continue to regularly update the record through until the decision's issued. What we're asking is that the duty to develop the record should include a simple request when there is a gap of 5 years.
Okay.
Why are those records missing? Thank you.
Ms. Kuntz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elaine Kuntz on behalf of the Acting Commissioner of Social Security. I would like to begin by clarifying what the agency's and the ALJ's duties here are in developing the record. The regulations in Section 1512 set out a shared responsibility to gather evidence. So under subsection B, the agency has the responsibility to develop a complete medical record, which the regulations define as a medical record for at least 12 months preceding the date of the application. The regulations then very clearly shift the burden onto the claimant to provide any updated medical evidence. Under subsection A, the regulations state that the claimant must inform the agency about or submit all evidence known to the claimant that relates to whether or not the claimant is disabled, and the duty is ongoing and requires the claimant to disclose any additional related evidence about which the claimant becomes aware.
Ms. Kuntz, could I ask you to address the point in the plaintiff's reply brief at page 12 in the middle of the page, he says the SSA website provides the form with the following cover page instructions. You do not need to ask doctors or hospitals for any medical records that you do not already have. With your permission, we will request your records. The information that you give us on this report tells us where to request your medical and other records.
So that form and the instructions in that form do not alter the regulatory burden in any way. What that form is saying is that it's filled out right at the beginning of the application process as an information gathering tool, and the form says, if you tell us what your medical sources are at this time, we will request that evidence. And that is what the regulations say under subsection B. We will gather the medical evidence for the 12 months preceding the date of the application. But there is nothing on that form that says going forward, we're going to continue carrying that burden for you. Now, separate from the regulations, cases have recognized the non-adversarial nature of the Social Security system, and they have created a limited expansion of this duty to develop the record. This is almost exclusively applied to unrepresented claimants or those with severe mental impairments or cognitive disabilities who are not able to develop the record on their own. The facts of this case do not create that sort of heightened burden that for the ALJ to develop the record. Not only did Berteau have an attorney here, he had hired that attorney more than 4 years before the date of this last ALJ hearing and decision. This case had been remanded by the Appeals Council twice, and after both remands, Berteau's attorney updated the medical record. And significantly, the ALJ asked the attorney if the record was complete, if he had had a chance to review the record, and the attorney said, the record is complete to the best of my knowledge. Under these facts, there are no special circumstances that would enhance the ALJ's duty, and there is no question here that the agency satisfied its duty under the regulations to develop this record. So the court's review of this case can end at the duty question and find that the ALJ satisfied the duty to develop the record and no further inquiry is necessary. Turning briefly to the second question, if the court does reach the question of prejudice, A review of the supplemental record shows that there is nothing in this record that would, what that was reasonably likely to change the outcome of the ALJ's decision. As we laid out in our brief, these records are often duplicative, and they show Berteaux making the same subjective symptom complaints that he made throughout the original record. There are no objective findings or new treatment that would corroborate Berteaux's subjective complaints. And significantly, as we pointed out, these supplemental records show that Berteaux performed a much wider range of daily activities than he had originally testified to. In addition to the surfing, we have records showing that he was boxing and jump roping. And 5 months after the decision was issued, Berteaux told his physical therapist that he was helping a friend move furniture upstairs with no issue. So here, because the ALJ took all necessary steps to develop the record, and because Berteaux has not demonstrated that the supplemental record was reasonably likely to call into question any of the ALJ's findings, if the court has no further questions.
I actually do. Sure. Let me start with, it's actually relevant for both sides, but we had other things to talk about with Mr. Duncan. Why is everybody citing so many non-precedential orders of this court as if they were precedents?
Because there is very few published case law on this issue.
Well, the way you make that point is to make that point explicitly. Maybe drop a footnote to some non-precedential orders if you can't resist the temptation, and then to invite us to issue a precedential opinion on the subject. What's your best Seventh Circuit precedent on the scope of the ALJ's duty to develop the record from your point of view?
The closest published case we have here is Johnson v. Barnhart. That was the 2006 case where the court found that an ALJ was entitled to rely on the statement from a pro se claimant that there were no outstanding medical records. Even the court found there that even a pro se litigant bears some responsibility for making a record. And I think the reasonable expansion of that case, the reasonable next step, would be that a claimant who is represented by an attorney bears even a greater responsibility for making the record, and the ALJ is more entitled to rely on the representations of an attorney.
So it sounds like there's still a duty on the part of the ALJ, right?
So there's no regulatory duty. What we're arguing is, under the facts of this case, there was no greater duty at the hearing for the ALJ to step in and develop the record at all. We're not asking for any sort of bright line rule, and I don't think we need to reach the question of a bright line rule. I think the facts here lay out pretty clearly that the ALJ's actions were reasonable in relying on the representations of the attorney.
Even with the 5-year gap?
Yes. I think it's also important to keep in mind the nature of Berteaux's impairment here. I think saying 5-year gap, saying 800 pages of medical records, sounds bad. But if you look at the record that was before the ALJ, he had this injury in 2013 and then 2.5 years of no answers. And he's reporting all of the same symptoms, and no one is able to tell him what's happening. And at the second hearing and the third hearing, Berteaux says, my impairment has not changed over the past 5 years. At the second hearing, he said he's not seeing Dr. Cheryl monthly anymore. He's not taking any medications. He's not treating his migraines in any way. And he was not receiving any mental health treatment. So you have Berteaux's testimony that nothing has changed. I'm not receiving any treatment. So a 5-year gap doesn't sound unreasonable under those specific circumstances. The court has no further questions. We will rest on our brief and ask that you affirm the ALJ's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our